Do you know that we take attendance each Sunday? We don't call the roll, but we do count the house. The ushers do that each time we gather for worship. Attendance at each service is added up and written in a book we keep in the sacristy. And at the end of the year, the total Sunday attendance is divided by the numbers of Sundays in the year, and we get the magic number, our average Sunday attendance. That number, ours hovers about 150, is used to determine the number of delegates for diocesan convention, how many voices we get to send to participate in the councils of the church. Sometimes it seems that the church is obsessed with counting. If I go to a clergy conference where I'm among strangers, others always ask about the size of our parish, the number of pledging units, and the average Sunday attendance. And at Christmas and Easter, we total up the number of people who came to all the services and check to see if it is more than last year or the year before. If it's going up, we count ourselves a success. And if it's not, we ask ourselves what we can do to boost it. In today's gospel lesson, large crowds are traveling with Jesus. Now, if Jesus had been serious about church growth, he would have dispatched those disciples to make sure that everybody filled out a visitor's card. Peter, James, and John might have been assigned the task of writing the welcome letters, inviting those in the crowd to come again next week or to consider becoming a member. Jesus would have worked more carefully on his sermons, too. He would have to make sure there was a practical, uplifting message every single week. As usual, Jesus doesn't do what we expect him to do. Remember, he's not calling crowds, he's calling disciples. He's calling people to transformation and new life. And he wants to make sure that those who are following him are aware of the cost of discipleship. I recently read the bestseller, Eat, Pray, Love, by Elizabeth Gilbert. I thought it had a great title. It chronicles her spiritual journey following divorce and depression as she sets off on a physical journey. She eats her way through Italy, prays through her time at an ashram in India, and falls in love again in Bali. Now, there's more to it than that. Lots of meditation and more than a little angst, but you get the gist. Finally, on page 175, Gilbert says this: "The search for God is a reversal of the normal, mundane, worldly order. In the search for God, you revert from what attracts you and swim towards that which is difficult. You abandon your comforting and familiar habits with the hope, the mere hope, that something greater will be offered you in return for what you've given up. Every religion in the world operates on the same common understandings of what it means to be a good disciple. Get up early and pray to your God. Hone your virtues. Be a good neighbor. Respect yourself and others. Master your cravings." We all agree that it would be easier to sleep in, and many of us do. But for millennia, there have been others who chose instead to get up before the sun and wash their faces and go to their prayers, and then fiercely try to hold on to their devotional convictions throughout the lunacy of another day. Good stuff. If even neophytes realize that there is a cost to discipleship, why does it always seem to catch us by surprise? When Jesus turned and saw the crowds following him, he was not impressed by his own success. And he certainly was not interested in the casual, easy acceptance the crowd offered. Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem. He may not have known exactly what was going to happen to him there, but he must have known that it was not going to be easy or pleasant. Those who were tagging along, hoping for another multiplication of the loaves and fishes or another dramatic healing, seem unaware that he is moving towards the cross and that his disciples will not be exempt from their leader's burden. If those in the crowd are contemplating being more than hangers-on and intend to be in relationship with Jesus, they need to know what they are getting into and to decide whether they can sign on for the long haul. His sharp words are meant to help people in their decision-making. They may make us uncomfortable, which may be good for us in the long run. Remember, please, that Jesus is being dramatic here. Hate was a Semitic way of expressing detachment. It is far more nuanced than the emotion-filled way that it's used in our culture. Nonetheless, it is important to remember that there is a cost to discipleship. Belonging to God affects the way we belong to others. Traditional patterns are transformed by the priority of our commitments. In the last few weeks, the gospel readings have challenged us to change our ways, to see with new eyes, and to rethink established patterns of behavior. As we become aware of people and their faith journeys, we come to know that the cost of discipleship is paid in many different kinds of currencies. For some, a redirection of time and energy is required. For others, discipleship involves a change in personal relationships, a change in vocation, or a commitment of financial resources. Transformation, the goal of the Christian life, doesn't come without a change of priorities, or at least a deepening of priorities. We see the challenges of transformation in Paul's letter to Philemon. Paul invites Philemon to begin anew with his slave Onesimus. Paul urges Philemon to transform that relationship, to receive Onesimus back, not as a runaway slave, which he was, but as a beloved brother. What Paul is asking will be costly for Philemon, in monetary terms to be sure, but even more in relationship terms. For belonging to God affects the way we belong to others. It is not always a pleasant thing to find ourselves on the transformative path. Yet it is only on that path where we can find ourselves in a place where God's grace can intercept us, intervene in our particular situations, inspire hope in our hearts, and bring about needed change in our lives. At a diocesan stewardship conference last year, Jennifer Azell, a member of St. Timothy's Church in Mountain View, shared her stewardship journey. She spoke about how her relationship to money had changed as she worked to be a faithful steward. More importantly, she placed her stewardship journey within the larger framework of becoming more serious about her life as a disciple. She spoke of five marks of a disciple. One who witnesses to an intentional faith as modeled in the baptismal covenant. 2, one who keeps the Sabbath and commits to attending worship every Sunday. 3, one who honors the tithe as the biblical standard of faithful financial giving to the church. 4, one who uses his or her spiritual gifts in the work of the upbuilding of the church. And 5, one who reaches out to others with the love of Christ. If we embrace those marks as both short and long-term goals, we too will embark on the journey of transformation, the journey of discipleship. We may be able to make only small steps on that path, but at least we'll be on the right path. Nurtured by God's grace and supported by the community of faith, we may find ourselves on that path and in that place where God's grace can intercept us, where God's grace can intervene in our particular situations, inspire hope in our hearts, and bring about needed change in our lives. Amen.